Welcome to one of Kathy Frey's Motherwise podcasts. Kathy is a best-selling maternity author and award-winning international maternity consultant. During her time as a midwife, she's caught hundreds of babies. So you're in good hands. Enjoy.
Hi, everybody. Kathy Frey here from Motherwise. And welcome to another webinar podcast. And today's topic is going to be all about day 5 to 7 after having a baby. So just as you're almost sort of ending that very first week. So quite a lot that I want to go over with you on that, quite a bit to sort of be aware of. So let's get into it. Firstly, with the mother. Okay, with you mummies, this is probably going to be typically the last time that you'll need a blood pressure check. After having a baby, there's a woman or all women, but some in particular, are vulnerable to getting preeclampsic toxemia after having a baby. But typically by sort of around that day 5 to 7, if your blood pressure hasn't gone up, it's not going to. And so usually by a week, that's the last time you really need a blood pressure check done, and then you're sort of done and dusted, typically. Okay. Fundus evolution. So around about the 10th day or so after having a baby, a midwife should not be able to palpate or feel your womb within your abdomen. By that stage, it should have involuted down and really be all behind your pelvic bones. But typically at around sort of day 5 to 7, you know, it'll be probably around about the sort of width of your hand or so below your belly button, but still slightly above your pelvis. And so the midwife will often just sort of, or somebody, an obstetrician, should kind of maybe check that that's where it is and everything's on track. But really, probably the main way that we can tell that everything's going well with your womb is the fact that you've got absolutely no signs of infection. You don't, you know, you have no fever. You don't have some foul smelling discharge. You're not getting horrible abdominal cramps. Women who have postnatal infections in their womb, which typically will occur at sort of 1 to 2 weeks really, but these are women who they know they're not feeling right. You know, it's not something that you can brush away maybe for the first day or so, but you're just not feeling right. So, but look, assessing your vaginal discharge. So after you have a baby, it's like just having a giant period. So when you have a regular period of menstruation, that wall of your womb, which has sort of filled itself full of all this wonderful blood-rich lining ready to receive a fertilized egg, obviously goes, well, I'm not having a fertilized egg. That's clearly happening. So I will slough it all off. And that becomes your menstruation. But obviously the lining of your womb for a pregnancy is way thicker and way bigger because you've got a great big womb, not a little tiny womb. And so that's it takes, you know, 4 to 6 weeks for that all to just, you know, get excreted through your vagina and onto a sanitary pad. And you don't be using I don't think it's a great idea to be using tampons during this time. You know, your womb is, the cervix of your womb is quite open, and we don't really want anything that could travel in there as an infection. Okay, so in that first 3 or 4 days after having a baby, that lochia discharge is called rubra. So it's because it's a dark red color, and it's usually sort of a fairly heavy flow, and you need some doorstop type thick sanitary pads typically. But by around day 4 to 10, in that sort of day 4 to 10 period, you typically go into the next stage of lochia, which we call serosa, which is a sort of pinkish brownish color. It's a much more moderate flow, and you just need a really regular moderate sort of sanitary pad for that. And then typically by around day 10 to 28, during that sort of period, is when your lochia becomes what we call alba, which is a yellowish, whitish sort of discharge, and really panty liners are typically all you need is a sanitary pad. So hopefully everything should be completely on track. But the site in your womb where your placenta was attached, that wound in your womb actually takes about 6 weeks to heal. So that's why we sort of typically say not good to have sex in 6 weeks. We don't really want to be introducing anything potentially into the womb of any foreign bodies that could bring with them some bacteria. So when you think of the size of that placenta, which was, you know, dinner plate size, a small dinner plate, sometimes a really big dinner plate, but typically a small dinner plate, or if you had premature baby, then it would be a smaller placenta, maybe the size of a bread and butter side plate. And but that is the size of the womb in your wound. Now, if that wound was on the outside of your body, if on the outside of your body where you could see it, you had this dinner plate size wound, everybody would be saying to you, oh, take it easy. In fact, you yourself would know to take it easy. But because you can't see it, you kind of forget about it, and you can overexert yourself in this period. You really can. And then on top of that, you know, you're getting sleep deprived every single day. So you really, you know, that comes back to that philosophy that if your baby's sleeping and you're not sleeping, you're wasting your sleep time. You must get onto that baby's schedule. Remember, you've got this huge wound inside your womb that needs to heal, and you need to rest for it to heal, because our body heals when we rest. Okay. As long as you're busy and active, it stays in kind of stationary mode. It's in neutro limbo. But when you sleep, your body can focus on healing. So that's really, really important. Can't emphasize it enough. Okay, sutures. Now, you may have some sutures in your perineum from an episiotomy or a tear. So usually, typically in about a week, somebody should visualize them. And certainly, what you should be able to say quite genuinely is that every day they feel a bit better. You know, that's the point. Every day, those sutures, that uncomfortable perineum should feel a bit better and a bit better and a bit better. If it is not, it actually every day, it is just getting sorer and sorer and sorer. Ouch. Not good. Okay, the first thing I would say to you, if you are my direct client, which you kind of are when you're on here, are you using Hypercal? I've already told you about it. If you've watched the other videos, Hypericum Calendula combination, using that cream, are you applying the Hypercal to your perineum? Every time you pull your pants down and you go for a wee, it should be sitting in your toilet. Put it on and slather the area. Wherever it's sore, you know, half a dozen times a day, absolutely wonderful. Because I can tell you, so long as you're using the Hypercal, I would be incredibly surprised if you've got a sore perineum. If you're not, okay. Chances are it's getting a little angry down there. The reason I tell you to use the Hypercal is because Hypericum is a natural antiseptic and Calendula is a skin healing promoter. And they both are also pain relievers, but particularly Hypericum, it takes away the stingy part of pain. So you use it and you're going to be feeling better. Plus you're promoting your skin to heal quicker. Plus you're reducing any chance of there being a local infection. So make sure you're doing that. But if you are in the very rare situation that your perineum is getting sorer and sorer, and you are using Hypercal generously, you can buy it from health shops or some pharmacies, depending on the amount of natural stocks of products that they supply. And if you are doing all of that, that's really unusual. And you definitely, somebody of a profession, a midwife or an obstetrician, should have a check of it. Preferably the person who actually did the suturing, to be honest. If they're your caregiver that is, you know, that you've paid, that you is your private caregiver, then they should be checking that for you. Now, the same or similar applies to a wound for a C-section. So typically around, you know, about a week is when some sutures may be removed or the dressing is removed. Well, you have to remove the dressing to remove sutures. If your obstetrician used staples, that's typically around that time when they would be removed. With women who have particularly pendulous bellies, if you are a little bit larger, and, you know, that incision is really into a pre-existing crease, you know, that you sort of, the belly hangs over. Sometimes I think that it can be better to just leave things alone up to about day 10, just to give, particularly staples, like just, you know, leave them in just another couple of days or so and give them a little bit longer. Because the whole purpose is the fact that they want that skin to come together. But women with those larger bellies can have a little bit of an extra strain on that wound. But look, this is something you should be discussing with your health professional, not me, or we can bounce ideas off me, that's for sure. But, you know, you should be fit. It's really just me telling you hopefully what you're already being told, and it's all making sense, and it's all, the advice is all matching up. Okay, your breasts. Now, sore nipples. Oh, wow. We'll see if we have time to go through this. But look, I have just got so many. I'm getting my book out here. I call this my 10 steps to help cure SNS, sore nipples syndrome. Look, there are so, this is absolutely not the time to do breastfeeding hurry curry when you just go, oh my God, it's all too hard. My nipples are falling off. I'm in so much pain. Look, we can get you through this. There's some really good, sensible techniques that we can help to make a huge difference. So I would, hopefully you've already got a copy of Oh Baby. Have a look at those 10 points and we'll see if we've got time to run through some of them later on today. But yeah, it's totally, totally curable. Totally. We can fix it. You just have to know the right way to do it. Okay. And some of my opinion differs from other health professionals, but I know what I'm going to tell you works on that. So make sure you've got a copy of your Oh Baby. You should have it. It's just so much information there, particularly around so many things. But anyway, okay, what else? Now, baby. So around about day 5, 6, or 7 is when baby would typically have a 1 week detailed clinical examination done. So they had one after they were born. Typically, that should be sort of 1 or 2 hours after they're born, because the first thing they should have received is skin to skin on you, so long as everything's healthy and normal with baby and with you after that birth. But, you know, sometimes babies need to, especially if they're premature, they might be in NICU. But Skiboo, the neonatal intensive care area, or the special care babies unit. In a healthy, normal baby and everything's fine and you've come home, a baby should really have that check in about 1 week. So it's a recheck of everything that's already been checked, and especially doing their height again, because their head circumference, checking their reflexes, like the startle reflex, where they go like that. And also checking, a good check for a short frenulum, which is a tongue tie. It's that little bit under here. Oh, I have a good look at my mouth. So yeah, that's your frenulum, and make sure that somebody should make sure that your baby's not tongue-tied. Okay, this is also the time where if your baby was receiving the oral version of vitamin K rather than the injection after birth, that's typically given at day 1 week, 1 month one. So around this time is when they would have that next dose. By the way, the taste of it is absolutely foul. Okay. I remember I used to do this with student midwives, that when they would be giving babies oral vitamin K, I'd say, right now, there's always this tiny little weenie amount left in the little container that it comes in. And I'd say, okay, taste it. And I'd go, it's not very nice. So what I would say is just have your breasts ready to feed baby afterwards, just to be kind. I mean, you know, it's not hurting them, but it's just not very nice. It's got a strong aftertaste because it's exactly the same medicine that is given to them by injection. It's not like there's an oral flavored version of it, or generally I've never heard of that anyway myself. Okay, what else I want to go through? Oh, I want to specifically talk to you about weight loss on the baby. Now, it is important that at around sort of day 5, 6 at the latest, I think, really, that you need to know what your baby's weight loss is, okay? And as long as it's around 7 to 8% or less, that's normal, physiological. In fact, what I would say is anything less than 7% is absolutely fantastic. And you've got an amazing milk supply and your baby's feeding really well and you should be totally chuffed. It's not very common. Where I do see it particularly commonly is a second baby, when it's not that long ago that mother was breastfeeding her first baby. So she usually rocks into a pretty big supply pretty quickly. So those second babies get a benefit of that. But okay, if the weight loss is around 10%, then look, that's usually okay. The health professionals should assess their behaviour. And as long as they're vigorous, that's all good. But if there's any sort of, if they're looking rather a bit lethargic, I think it could be a good idea for them to have a blood sugar level check, right? Which is just a little prick on their heel. And, you know, you just want to know that they are not hypoglycemic. Now, if the baby has got sort of somewhere around about 11 to 13%, then what I would say is, again, a blood sugar level check, but also probably a urinary blood sample collected. That was the urea and electrolytes. You just want to know everything's all good. And also, you know, it would be typical for that health professional, be it your doctor or your midwife or the obstetrician, to probably make a phone call to the pediatrician and just say, hey, you know, this is what we've got. Let's make a care plan with this baby. And then if the baby was at around a 14 to 15% weight loss, that's way more serious and incredibly unusual, I'd have to say. So again, you want blood sugar level checks, you want UNE blood, a little tube of blood taken for UNEs. Does that baby have hyponatremia, which is low sodium? That can be a concern, you know, especially if they're lethargic, they're irritable, they've got low urine output frequency. With all of that sort of, maybe a little bit of fever, a bit of a doughy skin, those babies need to see a pediatrician. It can be an indication that there is some other underlying concern. Probably the commonest thing I've seen in that situation is that there's actually a cardiac issue going on with that baby. So unusual, and that's why it's important to know. But, you know, also what I would say is that babies who are at that sort of 13, 14, 15% weight loss, they also tend to show it on their faces. They look unhappy. They have what we call a wizened look. I'm going to look at myself and try and imitate it. Okay, it's like this. They frown. They don't look content. They look worried. Yeah, it's a really unusual, it's so rare that you see it that, you know, I can pick it. I just can walk into a room and go, whoa, that baby doesn't look right. Unusual. And a time when I'd see it commonly is with a mother who, it's a first time baby and she just hasn't picked up on it. I mean, how do you know? And the other time, to be honest, is when it's a baby of a woman who's really busy with a lot of other kids. It's her fifth or sixth baby and she's just kind of missed it and she's just kind of lost track of how often she's feeding this little munchkin a bit. Okay, so when we see that, other things that need to be assessed is how effectively is this baby being fed? You know, what is the breastfeeding going like? And, you know, do we have audible milk transfer occurring? Now, when a baby swallows, it sounds like a sound. I'll say to you, it's like a So, and you can what? You can sort of hear them and feel them. And it'll be like, you know, when they'll be sucking. Hopefully you could hear that. It's a really little sound. But it's definitely distinctively there. So you want to know that you've got these audible swallows, that there's good, you know, milk transfer going on. In fact, if there is, you won't have a baby with that kind of weight loss. So that's a kind of another red flag that, hey, maybe things aren't going quite as they should be. Okay, but going back to a baby who's had a lovely normal 6, 7, 8, 9% weight loss and everything's hunky-dory, then the other couple of topics that I just want to whiz through, controversial topics. Firstly, pacifiers or dummies, they're called in some ways, baba pluggers, and on-demand or scheduled feeding. Okay, look, again, I've addressed these topics in the book, but pacifiers, I'm just not going to say they're a bad thing because there are some babies who are really sucky babies and they are completely full and they're having fantastic feeds. But even after that, they're still a bit because and chances are they probably were sucking on their fingers or their hand or something when they were inside you. And maybe just give them back that limb and let them do it. Don't swaddle them so completely. You know, if you've had 9 months all your life, all you can remember is doing this on your hand, let them have their hand, okay? Let's face it, what most of us don't like about baba pluggers or pacifiers, dummies, what we don't like about them is the idea that we'll have a three-year-old running around with them all day, still sucking on them. Yeah, and I don't think that's great. I'm very anti that. Another whole topic. But anyway, look, what I would say is don't get hung up on the fact that you may need to use them. However, this is on the basis that your baby's having a great weight gain. Because I have also seen mothers many times when a baby is actually showing the signs of being hungry and are shoving, you know, baba plugger in there when they shouldn't be and the baby should be getting feed. So I think that's probably the biggest concern that we it shouldn't occur. Now, the other thing I wanted to talk to you about is on-demand feeding versus scheduled feeding. And look, I'm actually just going to read from my own book because I just think this is a good explanation. Okay, so on-demand feeding works on the premise that babies should receive food whenever they desire it, and they are too little to be regulated by a clock. So whenever they signal that they are hungry, they should receive food. This is a baby feed mythology. Now I'm just kind of skipping through this. The anti-demand feeding experts feel that this is, it's too easy to misinterpret many of the baby's other cries for hunger. And certainly if your baby, if you are feeding your baby 10 to 12 times every 24 hours, you are probably misinterpreting. Okay, so then with scheduled feeding. Now, scheduled feeding has a reputation of employing a regimented, inflexible routine of clock watching to predetermine the time of each feed. And certainly, you know, that kind of, you know, was very much in the 60s. And it was very much based around formula-fed babying as well. And of course, the anti-scheduled feeding experts can produce statistics that say it's terrible and horrible and everything else. Look, what I would say is that there's actually an in-between, okay, where the baby does get scheduled feeds, but it's not to a clock. And this is what we'll talk about more later. But what I want you to do right now is not get caught up on it, okay? This is not the time to be fretting about it. Your milk's only just come in, all right? So just go with the flow for the next 2 or 3 weeks and we will get to that topic, and that is the right time to do it. So that's everything for today, and I wish you all a wonderful week. Bye, everybody.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast today. Visit kathyfrey.com for lots more free maternity information and downloads. Plus, you can order copies of Kathy's books, browse through her top recommended motherhood products, and check out her popular support package options. KathyFrey.com.